Well, Austin, you wrote an interesting blog post this week that's gotten some attention around the blogosphere. You called it Beware the Black Hole of Time.
Beware. And
that's at least an intriguing title, even if you didn't like the post. I'm just kidding. But it is an interesting title. What is the Black Hole of Time?
Yeah, actually, this goes back something my wife and I would joke about as we've as with anybody, really, you visit different churches, maybe you move, maybe you have a change of convictions and you're looking for a new church. You visit the church and people come up and say their initial hellos. Usually you're pretty popular on the first Sunday. And then maybe you're there on a Sunday where they have a fellowship lunch or maybe some other program that's coming up. And so let's say church gets out at noon and this next event begins at 12:30. Well, that space of time right there, that 30 minutes of time, is what we call the black hole. It's that period of time where you're standing there as a new person, and all the regulars are chatting with the regulars, or they're going about their church business. And you stand there awkwardly, and maybe somebody comes up and says hello, and then they feel kind of awkward, and they walk off. And then you're like, well, okay, I guess we'll head downstairs. You know, they're going to be having fellowship lunch. And so you go down there, and there's maybe like 8 children running around and one person sitting over in a corner, and you're sitting there feeling awkward and weird, and what am I doing? And next thing you know, you're fleeing out the door because you just feel so weird. And that's the black hole of time.
I see. We could, at our church now, we have a half hour between the Sunday school, their Bible classes, and then worship. So I guess that would be the black hole for that.
That's
for that
the black hole town. New people don't know where to stand, where to go. And if, I mean, you feel totally out of your element.
So what were you trying to accomplish in your article?
Really, what is the antidote? The antidote is that the regulars need to quit being so selfish, frankly. And to recognize that you need to be a friendly host and to go out of your way to make these people feel warm. And really the way you do that is to introduce yourself and give a handshake, but not just stop there, but actually engage, you know, the people with what's their life all about, you know, family, work, spiritual journey. I'm not saying bombard them with questions, but just take an interest in them, right?
As well as help shepherd them along to whatever the next activity is.
That's just it.
Meeting other people in the church, perhaps introducing them to others, that type of thing. Yep.
Exactly. Yep. Introducing them to other people. That's a powerful thing. Or we actually had the experience of we went to a meal and we entered. It was pretty much right at the time when it started. Most of the tables are pretty full. We have our 5, so we sit down at a table, and we sat there for a full 45 minutes by ourselves. One person came up and talked to us for maybe 1 minute.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. We should name names.
Yeah. I'll do what Kyle did. Ready? I'm gonna say it. All right. Mute button's off now.
Okay.
So I mean, here's the thing. We often talk about to the congregation, to fellow Christians, how we need to be zealous for evangelism, right? But how ironic when people actually visit the church and then you don't even pay them 2 cents notice. It kind of blows my mind.
Right.
You have golden opportunities with people when they come in to really befriend them. If someone has just moved into the community, and I can speak from experience because I just did that, we are desperate for people to be friends with that we can get to know, who will invite us over to their house and that we can become friends with. Without that, you feel a little bit in the desert.
Right.
And you start sounding like the psalmist pretty quickly.
Right. And this isn't necessarily either a small versus large church thing.
No.
You know, you would think a small church, well, they're going to notice a visitor and,
no.
quote, be all over them. But
no,
that's
no.
not necessarily the case. I know some small congregations, it's easy to get stuck in a rut. And then when a stranger comes into their midst, they just don't quite know how to handle it. There might be one or two who make an effort, but the congregation as a whole just doesn't seem to know how to engage and interact with new people around them.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever felt this personally, either one of you?
Oh, Rachel and I did. When we first moved to Grand Rapids, I won't name names, but we started attending a church, and they had that awkward coffee time between the church service and Sunday school, and, you know, and it was a fairly large church. There were 400 people there, but immediately people would go into their little circles, and we would literally stand in the middle of the fellowship hall, kind of just looking, you know, wanting to stick around for Sunday school, but it was so awkward, we often just ended up leaving. And Rachel kept telling, you know, I was the one that really prompted us to leave, and Rachel kept saying, no, we can't leave, let's just stand there, let's try it. Kyle, you're social, and I was like, I'm social, but this is just awkward for me. And actually, when we brought it up, the funny part was, is that leadership told us, well, yeah, people are in their own circles, but feel free to just butt in.
Yeah, right.
No,
the onus is on who, right?
Right.
The onus is on the regulars, yes,
So how do you help churches with this? What are some practical things that we could suggest to help congregations in this area? Because I've seen it quite a bit too, even as a guest preacher. I mean, I've gone into places and I'm kind of wandering around trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do, and I'm preaching.
Yeah. Well,
Barry, I preached once. And after the sermon, I stood in back for 45 minutes and not one person talked to me.
Yeah. Amazing, right?
Right.
Okay, I have a couple thoughts. On the one hand, I think the first thing to do is just to have a conversation. I mean, maybe the congregation just needs to be reminded of this, of basic hospitality, basic... what's Philippians 2:4 say? Look not only to your own interests, but the interests of others.
Mm-hmm. That starts with leadership. When you say have a conversation, the elders of the church, as part of their shepherding ministry, should be observant of this fact. And you would think the pastor and the elders would, if they're seeing their congregation not really working at ministering to people, they would help them in that. We're in a congregation of a couple of hundred people, and there's a lot of students from the Geneva College nearby, but our pastors do a good job of trying to encourage us and find ways that we can interact and engage, because we're just constantly getting new people coming through, especially students, and trying to find ways to engage them. So I do think it, you know, when you say have a conversation, it really starts with the leadership leading in that.
And I would say too that this is more challenging for introverts. I get that. Some people are by nature awkward conversationalists, and that's fine, that's okay, I understand that. But maybe out of some of the leadership, maybe some of the deacons who are more extroverts and good at it, maybe they should be kind of the go-to guys, and maybe some of their wives too, to really, it's like on their minds to I'll give you an example. Actually, when I was visiting Sycamore, can you guess, Barry? I won't put you on the spot, but Jenny Camry was wonderful to us, made Beck and I feel so welcome, and she was huge in just, hey, you know what, we're going to be having fellowship lunch here in just a little bit, we'll meander down there a little bit. She would just stay by our side and just talk to us, and then when we would go down there, hey, come sit with us. Super practical, super helpful.
So it's a place to encourage people with gifts in that area to make sure they're fully exercised.
And something else, I move quickly personally towards, if it's anybody within kind of my age group, I'm inviting them quickly to do one of two things: come over or play disc golf. if they don't want to play disc golf, that's fine. But I'm at least I'm throwing it out there. Like, hey, you want to get together? You want to play some disc golf? You never played? Great. I think you'll love it. If anything, it doesn't matter if you're terrible at it. I got a couple extra discs. You know, we're walking through the woods. It's just nice. We can just chat. Even if you're terrible, so what? Who cares?
Right. And talking about people your age, I think this is a great place to train our children, because I've seen a lot of times people come visiting and they have children, and particularly the preteen and teenage children can tend to be clicky anyway, and awkward. They're so awkward. It's awkward, mom. It's awkward, dad. You know, you hear that all the time. But you have to push them and train them. You got to just go and give them a few questions that they could ask this person, or tell them to invite them over to sit by them. That type of thing's really, really important to helping the children adjust as well.
Yep. Yeah. For people who are very concerned about church growth, I am absolutely convinced that this is an area that a lot of churches are failing in to some significant degree.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, if you go to some of the church growth conferences or read, they'll put such an emphasis on this that it almost gets to the level of being hokey, you know, where... Right. You know, I'm the minister of greeting or whatever, you know, where they raise it to a level of like you've been ordained to be the greeter.
Wait, is that bad? I'm the pastor of preaching and greeting in Winchester. Is that not normal?
Well, okay, to put some flesh on it, we were visiting a church in Warsaw, Indiana. And I remember two men came up to us pretty quickly and warmly introduced themselves, and it was nice. Well, come to find out later, yeah, they were like the part of the assimilation team.
The A team.
And the A team, right. And that was okay, except that they were, so far as I can remember, the only people who did that. So you kind of go, eh. You know, oh, the only people who took an interest were the ones on staff.
Wait, you're getting paid to like me?
You're getting paid to like me. It's like, oh, bummer.
I've heard churches doing things too where they just can go overboard, you know, having oil changes done during the service for, you know, if the guests park in a certain spot, you know, that type of thing.
Oh, no.
That's obviously overdone. We were at on vacation in Michigan. We went to a little Reformed church. We didn't know very much about it. It was clear that it was a dying congregation that had a young pastor that was trying to bring a reviving spirit to it. And we ended up being very encouraged in that little group. And one of the things that afterward, they had a little gift for us as we were walking out, this little old lady. I think if it had been anyone else except this little old lady, it would have maybe come across forced. But you could just tell this lady loved her apple butter, and she made these jars of apple butter. And I think it was apple butter. Anyway, it was something like that that she had homemade and had put a little ribbon around the jar and handed it to us. And we just thought that was really, really kind and touching.
Right. Generosity. Yeah. Warmth.
You know, I think I don't think most churches are in danger of overdoing it, but actually the first church Rachel and I started to be members of in Wisconsin, it was really funny. The first week we showed up, they were very, very great. They were very warm and very inviting. By the second week of my visit there, I already had a mailbox. So, which kind of creeped me out in some ways.
Wow. Moving quickly.
Yes.
Yeah, if they put you in the church directory after the second week, that's a little bit, that's desperation.
Moderation in all things.
Yeah. Sometimes I laugh because there was a season in our life at our Sycamore where we were a small congregation and there'd be a visitor, and afterwards it was just like the whole church just went boom, you know, just... There, everybody was grouped around this person, and we had to be a little careful not to scare them away.
Yeah, well, yeah, there is that too. I mean, obviously, you got to read people. I've certainly approached people who seem like, you know, deer in headlights, and okay, you know, we'll back off.
I have to tell this story. I was tempted to start a list of, you know, 10 things we will not say to first-time visitors. I had gone door to door and met this family, and they ended up coming to church one Lord's Day, and one of our enthusiastic members was talking with them and started telling them about the congregational shootout we were going to have next Saturday, and was inviting these folks to it. And he was so enthusiastic about this, he was talking, you know, he was acting like he was shooting a gun. Yeah, we're just out there firing away at the hillside, bam, 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 bam. And he's talking, and I'm not kidding, as soon as he was done, they were gone. So that was one of the, you know, on the list of 10 things not to say to New Time visitors.
Oh, man. Come
to our shootout.
Your militia gathering. So, Min, I want to talk about something with respect to preaching. Mm-hmm. Now, Barry, this is your forte. So, and as you know, there are books all over on preaching, and a lot of them will give you instructions on how to preach, the mechanics to it, the do's. But I want to know what the don'ts are. I mean, I have obviously anything that puts you to sleep is a big don't. But I'm just curious. You both are men who preach. In your minds, what are some of the big and minor don'ts, the do nots for preaching? And I'm just curious about your thoughts on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not only my forte; it's certainly Kyle's as well. So,
well, true. Yeah, true.
Let's hear what Kyle has to say.
Yeah. Oh boy. Well, let me. So my first one, and maybe this is a little more humorous, I would just simply say that when you're in the pulpit, don't forget your manners. And what I mean by that is, I was preaching one time, and somehow, it's the only time it's ever happened to me. I've been preaching pretty regularly now for almost 6 years, and the first and only time where I, in the middle of a sentence, I burped. And seminary never taught me how to recover from that moment.
I mean, it was audible?
It was audible, and it was recorded.
So
and
it's sermon audio,
somewhere in sermon audio is the sermon that I burped into the microphone, and everybody could hear it.
Yeah.
And rather than, and I pretended it didn't happen. And my wife afterwards came up to me, and she said, "Oh, honey, when that happens, just say excuse me, all right? Because it was so obvious." And she said, "And it was more funny and distracting by you forgetting your manners than it would have been if you just said, 'I'm really sorry.'"
So
I'd say,
keep your manners.
Yes, keep your manners. Don't forget them. Don't get up to the pulpit and let them go out. But maybe a little more seriously, and in no particular order. Some are bigger, some are smaller.
Yep.
You know, I think. One of the biggest ones that I have learned is to be very cautious about modifying your preaching based on somebody's opinion on what you should be preaching. And I want to qualify that. I think that a session is responsible to oversee the preaching of the church. And so good elders will review sermons and you know, as you together as elders have your finger on the pulse of the congregation, you decide together what is working, what is not. Mm-hmm. But it's very easy to let the pulpit or let the pew control the pulpit, as Martin Lloyd-Jones used to say. And I have found more often than not, and the criticisms can become heavy, and sometimes you begin to modify your preaching. Well, this person came and they expressed this, so now I've really got to adopt a new method. But as soon as you adopt the new method, somebody else comes up to you and goes, "What are you doing? Mm-hmm. Why did you change?" You know, and so this idea of modifying preaching on the basis of somebody's opinion, or maybe extend that. Sometimes I you know, as I'm writing a sermon, I think, or I hear so-and-so is going to be there, and I think, oh, you know, this could be a very timely message for them, and then they don't show up. And so just, you know, never let the pew really dictate the pulpit, I guess is what
So this is the don't be tossed to and fro by the criticism of the people.
Yes. Yeah. So Spurgeon always said have one deaf ear and one blind eye when it comes to that. And I think now when your session is telling you, "Hey, you know, you need to work on this," I think that's when you really pay attention to it.
Sort of a reflection of that back at the seminary level is when I was going through homiletics, after we preached, the next class would be everybody in the class commenting about the guy's preaching. And I found those just greatly disturbing because a lot of the men didn't, I would hear contradictory things, and it seemed like everybody was trying to one up the next guy. And so I've told, you know, the guys in my classes, you can go talk to someone about their sermon. That's fine. You might want to read the book of Proverbs before you do it. But I just, yes. I have the student preachers just seek professors' input to make it more of a coaching and mentoring type of environment. Hmm. But it's that same type of thing that you're talking about, Kyle.
Hmm. What else you got, Kyle?
I'd add to that, maybe a more lighthearted one. Be mm-hmm. sure you know how to pronounce the words. Yes. You know, so this is super embarrassing, and if you could see me, I'm turning red just remembering this. But within the last year, I was preaching here in Winchester, and one of my main points was the word predicament. Mm-hmm. But unbeknownst to me, for 32 years of my life, I pronounced that word incorrectly. And it was one of the main points of my sermon. And so I kept saying the word again and again and again and again. And I added an extra R. So I don't know why, but I grew up pronouncing it a predicament. And so throughout the entire sermon, I'm using this word predicament, and everybody is on the verge of tears. They're laughing so hard, and I'm sitting there going, you guys, this is serious? Why on earth is everybody laughing? Oh, and of course, when you have to stand in back and shake everybody's hands to a T, predicament. So pronounce words is a huge danger, a possible pitfall that will really change the whole flavor of the sermon.
Yeah. Yes.
Good advice. Yeah.
Maybe another one, and this is something that, with all due respect to the professor online here, it's hard to teach this in a seminary, but I think one of the biggest pitfalls, and I'm still a young preacher, so I'll say of young preachers, is to not know how to preach to the congregation in front of you. You know, in seminary, and when you're going around to this church and that church, you don't get a real feel for the real people and the real lives in front of you. And when you get a call from a congregation, you are called to preach to them. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you know, I hate to use it because it sounds like such a sly term, but preachers need to learn how to be a bit of a chameleon. Mm-hmm. To know how to change their approach, to change their methods, you know. Even as I reflect on my own preaching, the congregation that I did pulpit supply for in Grand Rapids is very, very different than the congregation I now have. And I think that's such a dangerous pitfall to not discern the people in front of you. And you know, if the people I was preaching in front of week by week were highly theological, I would challenge myself to be way more theological in my preaching. If they're more practical, I need to challenge myself to be more practical. You know, you need to use the vocabulary and the imagery and the illustrations that connect with the people in front of you. And I think that's a huge danger for young preachers coming out of seminary. They've gotten good mm-hmm. grades. Mm-hmm. People have praised their preaching. But sometimes the dynamic between them and the congregation really begins to fall apart because they don't know how to preach for the people in front of them.
Right.
And so
right.
that's just a pitfall I would warn against.
Kyle, one of the things I do tell the students is, and this was something that Ted Donnelly often said to me, is, you know, when you've exegeted the scriptures, you're only halfway done. That you have to also exegete your congregation. And you have to know their minds. And a lot of pastoral theological works talk about that, how different people are, and how different congregations are, and how important it is to really get to know them as a people so that you can speak to them more directly from the Word of God and apply it more faithfully to their hearts. So I think it's important. I even tell guys who are guest preaching somewhere that they need to go and ask the minister of that congregation a few questions before they get there. Ask him, you know, what's going on in the life of your church? Questions like this, what's going on in the life of your church? Is there any subject that perhaps me as a guest minister, I shouldn't be addressing at this point in time? For instance, there may have been someone who's gone through a tragedy and maybe a widow, a miscarriage, things like that. And if you come in as this young buck trying to speak to something like that, and you don't have the maturity and the delicacy of the situation in mind, you could just really hurt people unknowingly. So to just take 5-10 minutes to hear what the minister says about his flock and pray over that as you're preparing to preach to them, I think is an important thing to do.
Yep. Yep. And the last one that I'd throw out there is, I don't know quite how to word this or sum this up, but be sure if you bring notes or a manuscript, you know, know that you're bringing the right thing. And I say that because probably the sixth time I ever preached in front of a congregation, it was a congregation of 400 people, and I got up to the pulpit and I read my passage, and I then moved the manuscript that I had, the notes that I had, over the Bible, and I said, you know, let's bow in a word of prayer. And as I was praying, I realized I didn't grab the right thing. I actually grabbed a class paper.
Oh, no.
Oh, man. And so I'm looking there, and it was probably one of the longer prayers I've ever prayed, because I was panicking, thinking, what on earth am I going to do? I had no notes, no manuscript, no nothing with me in the pulpit. And, you know, my sixth time ever preaching in public, 400 people sitting there waiting for the preaching of the word. Anyway, be careful. And that actually ended up radically changing the way that I take notes and my own practice and what I bring to the pulpit. But, you know, even just little pitfalls like that can be so, they can be so devastating.
So what did you do? Did you just preach from what you extemporaneously, or?
Yes, I did. I don't know if it made any sense, but that's what I tried to do.
Preaching without notes would help, I guess, in that situation. I mean, if that was your regular practice.
Right. Barry, what are some that you pitfalls that you warn your students about?
Well, kind of on the preparation side of going to preach is I tell them not to mistake preparing their sermon from the preaching of it. That a lot of times guys can think that they're ready to preach just because they do have their notes or their manuscript there, but they haven't really thought through the actual preaching of the message. And there are times where you can just hear men in a pulpit, they don't seem like this word is on their heart. They don't come with that burden of soul with what they're preaching, because I think it's in their mind, but it really hasn't gotten down into their heart. And so I really encourage men to practice, to, you know, turn their desk into a pulpit. I get the guys to go and on their messages, do a devotion in their family worship, talk to their wife about their sermon. I think as you verbalize it more before you get to the pulpit, it's getting you ready. It's priming the pump to preach. So that's, you know, one pitfall I think is easy to fall into. I've got my sermon done, but maybe you really aren't ready.
You know, one of the best practices with regards to that, one of the best practices I had was my first 2 years when I was in Grand Rapids. I actually preached my sermon I went to the church early and I preached it in an empty room minutes before actually going up to the pulpit. And that taught me that valuable lesson. There's, you know, communicating through written word is very different than communicating through spoken word. And it really helped put, I think, more flesh onto the sermon itself.
Right. And that brings up another thought, just sort of ties into making sure you have your notes, is, you know, a pulpit can really throw you off. Like if you're not, it'd be good to get up there and just look at it and how you're going to lay things out. there's certain places, I won't mention the particular location, but they have their own pulpit Bible that takes up the whole pulpit. And might be in a strange language that you're reading from. So you might want to just...
The black hole pulpit.
That's another thing. You prepare, you're using one version of the Bible, but you're going to a place and they're using a different one. I think you should, you know, speak the home team's language. So use their Bible if at all possible. So anyway, that's just a few things in terms of preaching in other places. I think another mistake, and I just think this is rampant through particularly Reformed churches, I think it's one of the things, the concerns that T. David Gordon was addressing in his little book, Why Johnny Can't Preach, is that we, and I might phrase it this way, that we're attempting to grow hat sizes rather than hearts, that we're too concerned about conveying biblical information to people, and we start sounding like a commentary rather than really addressing the heart of the people that are before us. And that just takes a lot of work to, I think it starts with your own heart, and again, going back and really feeling the weight and the sense of a text that you're wanting to communicate. But it's also how I'm going to structure this message, what I'm going to put into it, what I'm going to leave out of it, so that I can best communicate to the hearts of the people in front of me. They're not just a big brain sitting there, you know, in the pulpits. Mm-hmm. They have beating hearts and living souls, and we want them to, and emotions, and we want to make sure that we're addressing the whole of the person and not just a part of them.
Mm-hmm. Which I think too, Barry, as I've reflected on that, that's why it's so fundamental, I think, for preachers to have a well-rounded anthropology. Mm-hmm. I think we need to see how a biblical anthropology informs the pulpit. And it's something that was very encouraged to us, I know, in seminary, in our systematic theology classes, that when we're learning anthropology, when we're learning about the doctrine of man, you are learning how to preach. And I thought that was very mm-hmm. helpful. So
Right.
And I was going to say it if you didn't tell us what anthropology meant, but another mistake is assuming too much. Like you could use a word like anthropology in a podcast or a sermon, and people are like, "What does that mean?" You know, or and not that word only, but lots of theological terms. And basically, I think in our culture, I mean, we can't assume too much even Bible knowledge anymore. We can't just refer to an incident in the Bible, a story in the Bible, without giving some background or detail. We're not living in the Shakespearean age where he could just weave in into the dialogue of his characters biblical phrases and expect people to understand what they mean anymore. So we have to simplify it and not dumb it down, but just be careful that if we're using a theological term, I think it's important for us to use theological terms. I'm not saying don't use them at all, but just like you did, you threw in anthropology as means the doctrine of man, that we would do that if we're going to use a term, and so that our people will be educated and ultimately knowledgeable about what these things mean. I think one other one I would, it kind of goes back to the just having too much information, is just overfilling your message with particular items. Like, I've seen guys who, you know, it's great to use cross references, but you start feeling like you're at a tennis match because you start flipping through your Bible all over the place. And you can actually, I think cross references should be used to bring light on the text, commentary on the text that you're studying for that sermon, meditating on for that sermon. But if you put too many cross references in, you could almost take people away from that text. So I think you have to use those carefully.
You also steal away, wouldn't you say? I think there are some times where a pile of proof text can be a very powerful a preaching tool, right? If that's a tenure of every sermon, then people, you know, it will lose its impact when you get to that moment where, let me just pile them on right now.
Right. I mean, that's what Paul's doing in Romans 3, for instance, as you were mentioning earlier about quoting from Psalms and other portions of Scripture to show us our depravity. And so it is effective, but like you say, if it's all the time, it becomes tiresome and distracting, I think, as does other things, such as, you know, the guy, I think we should be using stories and illustrations to help people to understand biblical truth and apply it to their hearts. But if you just start telling, I think it was Robert Godfrey, you know, talks about skyscraper preachers, you know, one story on top of another, you know, just boom, 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 boom all the time, that can be overfilling the message. As just, you know, TMI, just quotes is another place where guys make mistakes, I think. You know, it's great to have quotes, but they should be short and few. I liken them to maybe pepper. You know, just a few here and there sprinkled on can be effective, but too many of them, it just starts weighting. To me, it feels like it's weighting down the sermon, and there's just too much reading.
And going along with that, I think adding to quotes, the book review sermon, right? Where I have been in, I have listened to constant preaching that week by week. There's upwards of 12 references from this book and that book. And I don't know, I know we need to be careful of plagiarism in our own day, but if, you know, if you can find a way to express an idea in your own words,
right,
I say go with that rather than, well, as Tim Keller said, but as this commentator said in that one, you know, I'm not coming to church to hear a book review. I'm coming to hear the preaching of the word.
Right. And some messages can be so, I mean, it's just one book. Like, they're just almost going through. There's an idea out there in the evangelical world, and the pastor wants to preach on that idea, but then he ends up just quoting left and right from this one book throughout the sermon, and you start feeling like, wait, what's our preaching text? It doesn't feel like the Bible anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Probably just one last thing I'd add, Austin, as we wrap this up, is the older I get and the more I think about preaching and what really the men whose sermons I love to listen to, I just think the ones that are speaking clearly and simply are the ones that really resonate in my heart. The longer I listen to preaching, I think we so often are complicating preaching rather than simplifying it. And so I would say that's a big mistake, is we want to be known for our profundity and, you know, keen insight. And certainly we should have insight into scripture. That's why we're there in preaching. But we just need to be really careful that we're, my predecessor, Dr. Pruto, used to like to say, or remind the students and in his writings say, that a preaching is a shepherding activity. And so we should be bringing people along with us into the text so that they can find the nourishment and the rest for their souls in Christ as they're there in that text with us during that time. So.
And I think, you know, what was it, William Perkins, who said the greatest compliment you can get is, you know, that was a plain sermon. That was a plain and simple sermon. And I think that's true.
So can I share a few from the perspective of the pew?
No, you may not. The pew cannot control the pulpit.
The pew has no power. We have to just endure.
I meant, go ahead, Austin.
No, I'll fire them out quickly. Drives me crazy when pastors don't keep their finger on the text of Scripture. How many times have we seen someone read the text and then what they say has nothing to say about the text? Drives me nuts. It's like, why don't you just talk about whatever you want to talk about? So that'd be one.
And not showing the congregation where from the text you're getting what you're saying. Like, taking them back into the text a little bit.
It needs to, like, hey, amplify the text for me, please. I want to understand the text.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is talk to me. A lot of pastors talk to the back wall. And I don't mean just like I want eye contact, but there's a way to communicate that, like, oh, you're clearly reading a manuscript, and there's a way that communicates where, okay, you are talking to me. I feel engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll let you guys work that out, how you do the difference. I'd say beware of hobby horses. Seems like some guys bring their message around to their hobby horse often. It's like, okay, we've heard this before. Here we go.
Are always going to the latest social ill. Or the news, or the news item of the week, you know, always doing that. I think is distracting.
Two more that I jotted down. Some people think that I've heard this is like a bragging point. I've heard people brag this way. One individual said to me, oh, I know this old preacher who did 600 sermons on the book of Job. That's just ridiculous. I guarantee they were not preaching the book of Job. They were just doing Googling as they hit the word, it Googled in their mind and they went to a theme. They had to. There's no way.
There wasn't Google around when he did that.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what I'm saying?
Well, so this is a fair point. So can I push back a little bit, but also say I know people who agree with you.
I might push back on you.
So, you know, Martin Lloyd-Jones, I just read his first sermon on Romans 13, and he said, this is the 648th sermon in my series. Would you look at Martin Lloyd-Jones and say you didn't preach the book of Romans?
I'd say Paul was able to say what he wanted to say very succinctly, and I think Jesus did with the Sermon on the Mount. I don't think there's necessarily wrong, but my point is I can almost guarantee that a congregation has no idea what the previous chapter was in the book of Romans, because so much time has gone by and he's dealt with so much of the minutiae and talked about every doctrine in the Bible that they've lost a total sense of flow. That's what I genuinely believe.
You know, D.A. Carson agrees with you.
Well, hey.
D.A. Carson, I watched an interview between him and John Piper. You know, John Piper took, what, 9-10 years to preach through the book of Romans?
Yeah,
and
right.
Don Carson actually said, you know, if it takes... I don't know if he knew that or not, but he said something to the extent, you know, if it takes you 5 years to preach the book of Romans... You're not doing expositional preaching.
I agree.
I disagree, but you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible, but then you're starting to look like an 1,100-page commentary, is what you start to look like. I mean, and really, in order to accomplish that, my point is that Paul was able to communicate what he needed to about justification in like a couple chapters, you know, and the sinfulness of man in like three chapters. You know, he got to it. Now, granted, that's writing and not preaching, and yeah, he made some people fall asleep and fall out a window. But that's kind of my fear is when you get done with the book, do you have any idea what the book was actually about? That's my biggest fear. So as long as you can do 614 and still keep people to go, oh, I know what Romans is about, then
right. So
there you go.
So I think that's a very fair point, and I think as a pitfall, like Austin's been saying. When you preach, and you know, in our churches, most of the ones that we're probably in require expositional preaching through a book of the Bible, mm-hmm. you do need to labor long and hard to not miss the forest for the trees or the mm-hmm. trees for the forest. Mm-hmm. And yep. and that mm-hmm. is that's a very dangerous pitfall. That's a very difficult one, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. I think the last one is, and I think you men are going to struggle with this one too. They're too long. And I say it in all seriousness. There, maybe you can feel. I don't know if you guys can.
You who wants an hour long podcast,
right? Right. Ah, oh, the hypocrisy.
Yeah. Well, it's because, and here's why. Look around the congregation. By the time a pastor gets to the third point, you can almost see a wilting going on, unless it's a particularly powerful sermon. Or particularly gifted.
That's usually what I show the movie clip.
You start juggling.
No, it about there's something about the human, the normal person, at about the 30-minute mark, they're hoping that things are getting wrapped up. By the 40-minute mark, I can almost guarantee that just look around at the congregation. If they look like they're disengaged, they are disengaged. I really, that's just me.
What a good reminder that we need to take seriously what Jesus said, take care how you hear. It doesn't come easily, right? A love for preaching right. never comes easily. A love for hearing never comes easily. This is something that we need to work on. So,
fair,
Austin, what's the ideal sermon length?
Well, no, I guess I've heard some that were 25 minutes that were really good. I've heard some that went over an hour that were really good. Some of it is just maybe the nature of the speaker, the nature of the topic. You know, sometimes when you take a narrative, let's say you're going through, I'm just picking some, let's say you're going through Luke and you're in a narrative and you're pulling out your, you know, you want to cover three or four points, let's say. Well, if you can just sense that the people are getting disengaged, then either go ahead and wrap it up. There's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, just, hey, now you know what? Let's pick this up next time. There's nothing wrong with that. You don't have to do everything on your manuscript. Or liven it up. Maybe some, I mean, personal anecdotes actually go a long way in refocusing, at least me, and I know my wife and I. You just look around the congregation. It seems like if you tell a story or personal anecdote or something like that, it does snap people back in. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really helpful. So I would just say, if you're going to go longer, then just have these almost like reset button moments between your points to just kind of like get like, oh, okay, whew, all right, I'm back with you.
The Dutch in Grand Rapids, go through their first and second point, then they stand up and sing a psalm before they do the third point.
Hey, actually, that's a pretty good idea.
No, it so interrupts the flow. It's
does awesome. It really? Does it? Okay.
I think this goes back to earlier things we said about knowing your congregation and how to communicate to them, and also knowing yourself as a preacher. Can you really hold people's attention for that long? And the longer it's going to go, then the more you need to help the congregation get to the end of your sermon. So you need to be really thinking about that as you're preparing it. As Dr. Spear used to say in our homiletics class, if it's going to be long, it better be good.
So anyway, that's just some observations from the pew.
Well, it's pretty funny because in the chapel they only get 20 minutes. So in my evaluation, I make them do that or they get penalized. And it's pretty funny. They've learned to honor that all in all. And I've told them that if you can preach a really good message in the 17 to 20 minutes that you actually have there in the pulpit, you can always add more. But if you can't even preach a good 15-minute sermon, then you've got some work to do.
Yes.
So to me, it's good training because it is easier to expand once you've really got the kernel of truth that you want to convey that day and some basic support material for it. And to me, that's a good training exercise to preach well. But I tell them, I am not training you to preach short messages. I don't believe in short messages. My own career would show that. But so when they go to a church, I ask, that's another question to ask the minister. Or if you're candidating, that's another question to ask the congregation. How long do I have to preach?
What were you going to ask, Cobb?
So are you reflecting on your observations of Barry's pitfalls and his years of ministry with you?
Yeah, that's where he got all his material.
Well, let's see. What did Barry do that I didn't like very much?
Yeah, you just heard it.
No, well, thankfully, I do listen to a lot of different people. And, if I could maybe just close with one more thing did come to me. Yes, speaking well... there are elements that can be learned, but I mean, there are some people that just, I'm sorry, they should never be ordained because they're just not good at it. And I hope that, and this would be my encouragement to particularly you, Barry, is I would hope that dropping $60,000 wouldn't get somebody through if they're not meant for it, that a seminary would be bold enough to say, I don't think you're gifted for this. Mm-hmm. And I think that seminary would be willing to do that. But
that's part of the seminary's job, but it's also
it's primarily the
I mean, we can counsel men that way, but it's ultimately the presbytery's role.
Yeah, and they need to have the guts to say that. I mean, I have seen some guys that in my past, oh no, you are so not fit for this. I'm sorry, you're a nice guy, you're a holy guy, but nobody wants to hear you talk. You put people to sleep in 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's just a sad reality.
So hour-long podcasts,
mm-hmm.
but we need short sermons. Okay, I just need to write that down. I just need to make sure that I got that in my mind.
No.
I'm just saying, interesting. Like, do whatever you need to do to just keep people. I mean, there's just human weaknesses that, and the same thing with podcasting. I'm sure there's some people at this point who are going, well, they just shut up about preaching. Yeah, fair enough.
And so they did. This episode of 3GT is sponsored by the Reform Presbyterian Theological Seminary located in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. RPTS would like to invite you to our conference being held on April 21st through the 23rd, entitled Sex, Sin, and Salvation. You might ask, why would I want to go to a conference with that type of title? Well, let me give you a few reasons. A recent survey of men identifying themselves as born-again Christians indicated that 54% look at pornography monthly. 31% claim to have had a sexual affair while married. 78% said that they had viewed pornography before the age of 16. Every day, we are confronted by the impact of our culture's sexually charged direction, from the Ashley Madison scandal to Supreme Court rulings and more. So do you need more reasons why church leaders, parents, pastors, Sunday school teachers, youth leaders should attend Sex, Sin, and Salvation? If so, let me give you a few more. These numbers from within the church continue to increase, and most of us are ill-prepared to deal with issues that are already in our families and churches. The Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary, in partnership with the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals, wants to affirm the goodness of God in creating human sexuality while wrestling with the fall's effects on this gift of God. Above all, we want to testify to the power and grace of God in Christ to redeem this area of life. The conference is crucial in developing godly wisdom and dealing with the impact of sexuality in our lives. Every adult Christian will benefit from this conference, but especially so pastors, leaders, and Bible counselors. The speakers are internationally known leaders in theology, counseling, and discipleship, with names such as Derek Thomas, Rosaria Butterfield, Tim Challies, George Scipione, Heath Lambert, and others. We're really excited over the quality of leaders God has raised up to come to this particular conference. Christians will clearly be built up in the faith and equipped to thrive in the midst of these continuing shifts in our culture. So there's some of the reasons why I think you should come. Let me give you the information about the conference. The best way to find out more is simply to go to the Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary's website, which is www.rpts.edu. There on the main page, you'll see a banner advertising the conference. And if you just click on that, it will direct you to more information and how to register and so forth. As you go there, you can also learn more about the seminary. And we are thankful for RPTS sponsoring our podcast today. And I have to say, I'm excited teaching there as well, and would like to invite you to consider coming to RPTS and studying under pastors.
3GT is a podcast designed not only for your edification, but your enjoyment as well. Feel free to share ideas or input. We'd love to hear from you. Check out our website over at 3GT.fm for contact information, or simply write us at 3GuysTheologizing@gmail.com. Check us out on Facebook as well. Likes are always nice. We welcome those. And if you're feeling particularly warm-hearted, write us a review over at iTunes. Thanks again for hanging out with us. Hope you enjoyed. Until next time.